But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never.
Hey Callie.
Hey Michelle.
Here we are in person.
I love that for
us.
I know,
me too.
I love this room.
Yes.
Your witch broom, your dog.
Yes.
All your dog's toys. It's
my
all
dog
cute.
Has a lot of toys. Today we get to start talking about aberration in the heartland of the real. The Secret Lives of Timothy McVeigh by Dr. Wendy S. Painting.
Cool.
Which I have in my notes, aka Totally Righteous Babe.
Yes.
Yes. If you want to hear Dr. Wendy Painting talk about the book herself, you can do that for 14 straight hours on Program to Chill, on the podcast Program to Chill, which probably most of you listen to us also listen to you. But yeah, Dr. Wendy Painting, there's I think 7 episodes and they're all 2 to 3 hours long. The title itself, actually, Aberration in the Heartland of the Real, is from a Don DeLillo book titled Libra. So this is Don DeLillo from Libra, which was published in 1988. Sometimes he looked around him, horrified by the weight of it all, the career of paper. He sits in the data spew of hundreds of lives. There's no end in sight. Let's call a meeting to analyze the blur. Let's devote our lives to understanding this moment, separating the elements of each crowded second. We will build theories that gleam like jade idols, intriguing systems of assumption. We will follow the bullet trajectories backwards to the lives that occupy the shadows of actual men. There is much here in the aberration in the heartland of the real. It's a very good summation. I see why she titled the book this.
Yeah.
It's a very good summation of what she does in this book of the... Because she follows the different stories of what happened that day and how Timothy McVeigh was involved with it. She follows all of those stories. So that's, and this book is huge, everyone. If you haven't seen it, let me look how many pages there are.
It's an absolute unit.
Yeah. And I think she's writing a second one, and I think they might be making a film out of this somewhere. It's a little bit... Hang on. I mean, there's so much.
Thank God for her and like the dude that wrote Chaos. Just yeah. People who like really go in and don't mm-hmm. stop going in and compile all this stuff and fucking take the time to write it and publish it. Like,
oh,
it
yeah.
makes a huge difference.
Oh, yeah. I think people are starting to realize that Wendy S. Painting is not a crank. And that's like, that's, and you can't read this book and think that.
I mean,
the bibliography itself is like, a quarter inch thick. Anyway, it's 656 pages of just pure information. She's not messing with you at all on this.
And it's not even a huge font.
No, it's not even huge font at all. So here's a from the very first page of the book also. This is a, I'm going to read you a paragraph. In the immediate hours, weeks, and months after the explosion, a number of rapidly formed and highly conflicting narratives about both the bombing and the bomber appeared and spread. The stories developed over time and continue to circulate today. Their construction involves a complex and dynamic process of collaboration and competition between multiple individuals, institutions with various motives, agendas, and intents. Stated or implied, all of whom assert different facts based on different evaluative criteria. Authors of the stories include journalists, victims and survivors, eyewitnesses, the FBI, federal prosecutors, politicians, experts, analysts, pundits, defense attorneys, and notably, McVeigh himself. Within each narrative, the material facts, the chronology of events, as well as the roles and identities of the villains differ, as do the acts attributed to them and their purported motives. Everything comes back to Oklahoma for whatever reason.
Yeah. I mean, it is just like a crossroads of like MK Ultra and government meddling in the Middle East and white supremacy recruitment.
Yes. All of that.
And government cover-ups and the Clintons.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And killing children at the expense of the government for what?
Right.
Or not the expense of the government. Killing children. Like, the government is killing children.
Right. At the expense of society.
That's what I... That's... Yes. Thank you for wording my words better than I word them.
I understood it.
You get me.
That's true.
Thank God you're here to translate.
So one of the things, and we've discussed before, but she really goes into it in depth in this book. But Tim, anything you've heard ever about the Oklahoma City bombing, you can find it start with Timothy McVeigh himself. So he has told every version of OKC bombing that has ever existed. He told it for himself. He told the story of, no, he did it all by himself. He tells the story of, no, the government did it. He tells every single story, which I find fascinating about Timothy McVeigh, which also we have to keep in mind here. I am birthday twins with Timothy McVeigh.
Taurus.
Yep. April 23rd. But,
wow.
But he's older than me. But yeah, we're birthday twins.
That's wild.
I know, it's wild. And so I was like, do I relate to anything? And I was like, well, we're both wary of giving anyone a medical history, and we have great follow through. Thanks for laughing at my OKC bombing joke.
It's funny. I'm laughing because it's funny.
And what any of us, whatever story any of us believe, kind of depends on our own values going into it. So let me see. There was one line. The way
it's like interesting because then everybody could be like, no, this is what happened. He said it himself.
Yeah.
About every single version.
Yep. Yes. Amazing. Truly.
Convenient.
Right. Right. Convenient. Very convenient for some powerful people, probably. Paintings put it is, it depends on one's pre-existing beliefs about what is logical, plausible, implausible, palatable, or simply unimaginable. So if you're somebody who can't imagine that the United States government would blow up its own building and kill a bunch of kids, then you can't believe that story.
Yeah.
Right. If you can't believe that high-level cops like FBI, for example, would cover up for some collaborators in a bombing, then you can't believe that there were other collaborators, right? So it just depends on what you can believe or imagine. And I like how she says, too, palatable. We're going to go down a few basic like timeline points on this. Wendy Painting does a good timeline at the beginning. I'm not going to read all of them, but I'm going to read some key points from the timeline. And there gets to be some, right away, we get some of what we call some sus stuff. So May 1988, a 20-year-old Timothy McVeigh joins the United States Army and is sent to Fort Benning, Georgia, where he meets two people specifically, Terry Lynn Nichols and Michael Fortier, all of whom are part of an experimental cohort unit. So he's 20 years old, and he goes to this special place to do this experimental military cohort. You know, a cohort is just a group, but they were doing something experimental.
Top secret. Yeah. Only the most special boys.
Right, right.
Get these top secret secrets, like just like the G.I. Joes get.
Yeah, something like that. Yes. So And these two names become very important later, Terry Lynn Nichols and Michael Fortier, because something I think everyone forgets is that Michael Nichols and Fortier both went to court. Like, both of them did time for their involvement in OKC. But why do we forget that as a population? Like,
because people want it to be the lone gunman person thing.
Absolutely. And so did Timothy McVeigh sometimes.
Yeah. One part of him wanted that.
Yeah. Maybe one part of him, of the many parts that were, I don't know, developed in this experimental unit in Georgia.
For good special boys.
For good special boys. That's probably was what was in his MK Ultra football helmet was, "You're a very special boy, Timothy McVeigh. You're a very special boy." And then, let's see, in March of 1991... he went to Timothy McVeigh was in both Desert Shield and Desert Storm, which are wars that I certainly remember. And one of the elements of these wars was that they were very short in time span and that they were served up, at least to the domestic American public, as being basically not wars. People, troops, American troops who came home from these wars have ongoing health problems that I think now maybe are being, it's being seen as like, yes, you got this in Desert Shield or Desert Storm. Like, you had these, you have these health problems that are coming probably from chemical warfare being tested. It's like American chemicals being that were probably being tested maybe on the troops, but at least in the area. All right. So then from April 3rd to April 7th of 1991, he attends Fort Bragg to undergo psychological evaluations for special forces. Once again, he's a very special boy. It's a selection and assessment process from which he voluntarily withdraws and goes to Fort Riley, Kansas. Timothy McVeigh is born in upstate New York, and that's where he had done his...
Yes, like Buffalo, right? Outside of Buffalo.
Yeah, Buffalo. Yeah, because he winds up going back there for a little while to be a security guard somewhere. His story just it has a lot of turns, even like at the beginning, right? So he voluntarily, I'm putting quotes around that, withdraws and goes to Fort Riley, Kansas. Because one of McVeigh's stories, he tells his sister... I got into special forces. I'm a special forces guy. And then later on, it's like, oh, well, you know, Timothy McVeigh, he's this crazy guy that blew up this building. Like, he just told people he was in special forces, right? Which maybe he did.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. Or
he was in a different special force that they redacted from the record so that they could do weird shit to his brain.
Are listening to Secret Antenna, a completely unfunded podcast that we do for free. We made a Patreon to help us buy books and equipment, and we post full-length bonus episodes on there, mostly about topics we get a little more wacky on. Access to all of our content starts at $1 a month, and you can subscribe at patreon.com/secretantenna.
So he voluntarily withdraws and goes to Fort Riley, Kansas. And then in December of 1991, this is so weird, he ends active duty and goes back. That's when he goes back to New York, and he becomes for a while, he's National Guard there, which he's supposed to serve until April 11th, 1995. But he gets released from that service. He just keeps getting released from these things in this strange sequence, I think. So he gets released from the National Guard and he's put into Army Reserve, where he is screened and trained every year and can possibly be returned to active duty. So after he's released into the reserves and he's released from the National Guard duty and now he's a reserve Army guy, he starts traveling the gun show circuit. I don't know yet if he's selling guns, he's buying guns. The way it plays out in my mind, we'll figure that out later, but the way it plays out in my mind is that he's just trying to make friends and meet people, you know, like, right, networking or something, you know. I don't know, I feel like he's just hanging out, but we'll figure that out later.
I think too, it's like, if I feel like we talked about this in like an early episode, and I can't remember like what the name for it was, or if it's even the same thing, but it's like, if he is like publicly being like withdrawing from something, that's just like basically how you could like go undercover doing stuff. Cause it'd be like, no, I'm not a army guy. I'm just a guy traveling the gun show circuit. But like, are you actually traveling?
You mean sheep dipped?
Sheep dipped.
Yeah. I wondered that too.
Can you describe what that is again?
Oh, sheep dipping is when usually I think it's in alignment with the CIA, which is all in bed with the military anyway, but is when like they might take you out of the military and then make you anything, an accountant. You could be, I mean, Jim Bath. Right. We talked about Jim Bath a lot.
Yes, that's who it was.
Yeah. And he was in with the Bush family and right. And he was a pilot. And they took him out of the military and made him just a regular old like pilot who was flying planes for the Bush family or whatever. But actually the whole time he was a military guy. He was working for the CIA.
That's right? Exactly what I'm trying to say about little Timmy.
Little Timmy could have been doing that. Yeah. The Omnibus Counterterrorism Act of 1995 is introduced into the Senate by Senator Joe Biden.
Oh my God.
On behalf of the Clinton administration.
Fuck you.
An omnibus. I looked this up. So it can be a noun or a verb. And as a noun, it's often just a bus, an omnibus. And or it can be a book as a noun also. So it could be one writer with different essays, probably, or it can be on many writers on the same topic. So this is an omnibus as a noun. As a verb, it means to include many items or relating to many things at once. So the Omnibus Counterterrorism Act, according to President Clinton, the bill was intended to establish federal criminal jurisdiction over acts of international terrorism. So advocacy groups at the time opposed the bill on the grounds that it would violate fundamental civil liberties, including the right to confront one's accuser and to allow the government to use secret sources for deportation proceedings of suspected suspects. So you could deport someone from a secret source. Be like, well, I don't have to tell you who said you were a terrorist, right? And of course, also just in violating fundamental civil liberties. And I think this is what we see with the Omnibus Counterterrorism Act to this day, you know, 38 years later, is that it can just apply to all of us individually. Mm-hmm. Like the Omnibus Counterterrorism Act means that the government really literally could say about anyone, I heard you were a terrorist and I don't have to tell you where that's from. And terrorism is punishable by death, which I think before this it was not. So this right?
Oh, no. Because now they're calling everybody terrorists.
Now they're calling everybody terrorists. Right. So this was February of 1995. This happens just
setting it up.
Yep. Couple 3 months. What is that? Three months before OKCB. Yeah. So then the Alfred P. Murrah Building is bombed on April 19th, 1995, killing 167 adults and children. And that's just the people who are dead. I always want to remind us of this. There's lots of injured people, and injured can be anything. It can be paralyzed for life. It can be blind. It can be, you can lose your hearing in an explosion like that. I mean, there must be many people.
Yeah, like lives permanently changed.
Yeah, permanently changed. You know, I mean, if you lose your hearing in an explosion, like your life is completely different from that day forward. Or you lose an eye. You know, you lose an eye, you lose your hearing. You can't drive anymore. That you were not allowed to have a driver's license. Like your life changes irrevocably in that moment. Losing a limb. Just, you know, hurting your back so bad you can't work for the rest of your life or pick up your baby or whatever.
Oh.
You know, yeah. I mean, just to keep in mind that when we talk about the dead, we're not talking about the injured or what can really happen to you in these situations. And then even if you wind up getting out of this unscathed, your coworkers were killed. You witnessed something that you're never really going to get past in your life.
Yeah.
Honestly, right? Tram. And then that's the whole city of downtown. That's every responder that has to show up to this. So anyway, there's the carnage here goes beyond 167 dead people. But that happens on April 19th, 1995. So then, 2 days later, on April 21st, 1995, because hopefully we all remember that Timothy McVeigh is picked up immediately afterwards. He's driving a truck with no plates. And I think maybe he has does he have a gun in the car? I can't remember right at the moment.
It's basically like he has a big sign in his car that says, come get me.
Right. And they do, like, almost instantly. Like, he's arrested right away.
Like, a few hours, I think, yeah. Right?
Yeah. It's some very short distance of time. So they've already arrested him. But on April 21st, something you don't hear about much is that Terry Lynn Nichols turned himself in to authorities. And this is who Timothy McVeigh met 7 years prior in the experimental cohort at Fort Benning in Georgia. Then on August 11th, 1995, a federal grand jury indicts Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols for murder and conspiracy to bomb the Murrah Federal Building in a plot that involved McVeigh, Nichols, and others unknown. As part of a plea bargain, Michael Fourier agrees to testify against McVeigh and Nichols in exchange for immunity for his wife, Lori, and reduced sentence for himself. His wife, Lori, huh? What does she need immunity?
What's she up to?
Yeah, what's she doing? Was she just at home, like, keeping the calendar? And she's like, you got to pick up the manure today, baby, for the bomb. I don't know.
I know. I don't feel like I had heard about her when I was researching this last time. But I didn't read this book, so I didn't even... Yeah. Actually, Wendy S. Paintings was a writer, contributed to the movie that I watched that... I kind of was my main researching for when we did this episode really early on.
That's right.
In Secret Antenna.
A Noble Lie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
I don't remember that person. That's just interesting.
I know.
That's
immunity.
Like one more. Like, why do you need immunity, girly? Yeah. Why do you need immunity, girly pop? What'd you do?
What'd you do? What were you doing?
What you up to? What you need immunity for?
I mean, do you think she packed him a lunch? I'm just thinking of like wifely things. Like, you think she, like, packed their lunch and made sure they had jackets? I'm sorry.
Snacks for bombs.
But he asked for immunity for his wife. But he did some time, too. Michael Fortier he's in a witness protection program now. And I actually, we'll find out what happened to Nichols as we go along here. But I know Fortier is in a protection program. So, like...
Damn, needs so much protection from this lone gunman who got murdered, caught, killed by the state.
In May of 2004, from May of 2004 to August of 2004, Terry Nichols is convicted. Oh, yeah. Okay. Now here, I told you we'd get to Nichols. Terry Nichols is convicted of 161 counts of first-degree murder in the state court in Oklahoma City. And after the jury deadlocks, receives 161 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. But that didn't happen until 2004. Because something I also didn't realize until just looking at this book, Timothy McVeigh was only convicted of 11 murders.
What?
11 counts of murder.
How do you distinguish which of the people in this mass murder you were responsible for?
I don't know. But he was convicted back in 1995. I mean, by the time this thing goes on in 2004, he's dead. Timothy McVeigh was executed in 2001.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, but he was... Timothy McVeigh was convicted for... 11 counts of murder, 1 count of conspiracy, and 1 count of the use of weapons of mass destruction. And so it isn't until 3 years after McVeigh is executed in an expedited execution, which we've talked, if you want to hear about that, that's on previous episodes. But then it's 3 years later that Terry Nichols is finally convicted of 161 murders. Wild. And then this is the final timeline element here is on April 30th, 2015, federal judge. Now, this is 20 years after this building blows up. Okay. April 30th, 2015, federal judge Clark. Oh, my God. Wadoops. I'm not even kidding. Judge Clark Wadoops files an order appointing Magistrate Judge Dustin B. Pede as special master to determine if the FBI tampered with a witness who was going to testify about participation in an undercover FBI operation called PatCon. In November 2015, Judge Wadoops issues an order barring participants in the special master's investigation from discussing the process or the particulars of their participation. So, what's PatCon, you must be asking? And I'm going to tell you. So, this is from, I stopped right there with paintings book. I mean, I go on from, we'll do more paintings today. Painting. I keep putting that S on the end of her last name because it's Wendy S. Painting. Dr. Wendy S. Painting. Listen to me. I'm like mind controlling you all.
Wendy S. Painting.
Right. So anyway, but I took my own little detour into PatCon, and then we'll see what she goes into about it later on. So I'm going to tell y'all what PatCon is, because it's really important. I think PatCon is deeply involved in J6.
Oh.
Yeah. So PatCon was started in the early 90s, I think 1993. PatCon was started when an FBI informant who had been informing on the Hells Angels, he relocated to Texas and was informing on the Aryan Nation that was active in Texas at that time. And I'm going to assume he was in Austin because it was the FBI's. Okay, I have no idea what this is. All right, I'm just going to say the words and then maybe later we'll understand it. It was the FBI's Austin Resident Agency. What the hell is that? The FBI's Austin Resident Agency, who decided that this informant could do more if he had extra support. So what happened, this particular informant, there had been threats to three FBI agents by the Aryan Nation. And so this particular informant was like, look, I can get more involved in these threats. It's very serious. These are very serious threats. And if I have more support, I can get into these threats more better, right? So headquarters gives its blessing to the San Antonio field office, which is where apparently the Austin, I can't even say it, Austin Resident Agency reports to FBI headquarters in San Antonio. So headquarters okays the start of something they call PatCon, which actually stands for Patriot Conspiracy.
Oh my God. I wish I had said out loud, I bet that stands for Patriot something, because I knew it. Especially when you said it had to do with J6. I was like, right, it's got to be Patriot something.
Yeah. Patriot Conspiracy. PatCon's job was to collect information on rumors that a recreation of a group called The Order and other general anti-government groups had got started again within the Patriot movement. What was going on is the Patriot movement at the time.
And this is in the 90s?
Yes.
Huh.
In Austin.
Is this Alex Jones? It's gotta be.
I put that note here myself. I'm like, and then I went back. I'm like, when did he start his little like cable access thing? Was in 1991. And you'll hear all of the words that wind up coming out of PatCon. You'll be like, but that's Alex Jones. That's Alex Jones. I mean, it was all.
I'm sure like he is not the originator of all the stuff that he's pushing. He just becomes a mouthpiece.
He becomes a mouthpiece for it. I really think this PatCon explains him a lot. And I don't think he would even have to be in on it.
Yeah.
Right? Which is, Alex Jones has always just looked like this big mouth opportunist, like kind of like everybody look at me type guy. And you could so easily just go in and pretend to be anybody. I think he'd believe it. I mean, I just think he's so full of himself, you know? So you could go in from PatCon and be like, here's what's up, you know? Like, I'm the dark mouth in the stairwell or whatever. And he'd be like, that's goddamn right.
The dark mouth in the stairwell. Spooky.
What happens is FBI agents create a fake group that they call Veterans Aryan Movement. And they have a safe house in Austin. Now, the reason that they got all of this extra money to create this group was they were supposedly going to investigate these threats against these original FBI agents. These threats were considered so serious that they were given this, I think, substantial extra money when you get into this certain echelon of espionage. Like the first line informants, kind of informants to cops, either don't get much money or nothing. Sometimes they're just people who are in trouble, right? So once they decide like, oh no, we're going to make a thing out of you, you're going to have all the resources and money you need to accomplish such and such goal. That's when you get on the board, I think, so to speak. So this group gets itself on the board with, it's fake, Veterans Aryan Movement. So this is the FBI pretending to be Nazis. Pretending, quote unquote. Yeah.
Right. Pretending in air quotes.
Right. And they, in their business here to go check out what happened with these threats, they never go to any of the primary targets of those threats or investigate that really at all. They come back and they say, actually, that turned out to be nothing, but we want to do this other thing because the Patriot movement in general is trying to recreate this blueprint from this group, quote unquote, called the Order that had been lasted less than a year. The Order was a real Nazi group that had, you know, real Nazi ideas. And in less than a year, they managed to like murder somebody and go to prison, right? What happens is the FBI starts recruiting veterans, first of all. So these are people who have skills and trauma, right? So he's recruiting them, or the FBI is recruiting them. And they are laying out the blueprint for the Order's manifesto to them. So where they're coming in and saying this group is getting started up again and they're using these blueprints from this old group that we know was dangerous, right? And pretty and had a manifesto, right? It's the FBI.
Ooh.
That's telling this story to these people who are attracted to these veterans who are attracted to an Aryan movement. Like, why did the FBI do that?
It's like a setup, you know?
Right. Oh, it was Alan Berg that the Order murdered. He was a radio personality, a Jewish radio personality, and they murdered him. And they were shut down by
that. Fuck them.
Yeah, right. So their fundamental revolution against the U.S. government. Oh, that's what they were saying is that, oh, it goes into all this stuff. Their fundamental problem with the U.S. government was that it was run by a cabal of Jewish people, right?
So not the fucking cabal.
Not the cabal.
Dude, I've been hearing that cabal shit started coming around again when COVID was happening.
Right.
I'm so, like, the worst people talk about the fucking cabal,
the
dude.
The worst people. I mean, you know, including old Alex Jones. So he's right here in the midst. This is happening right there. So if you're one of these people and you look over and you're like, you see that guy right there? You see that rube? That's Alex Jones. And all you got to do is feed his fucking ego and he will do, and put some money in his pocket. He will do anything. But even more than money, it's that ego. You feed it, you get what you want, like putting quarters in a gumball machine.
Yep.
So, but that's the FBI, folks. So as far as I'm concerned, whether Jones knows it or not, he has always been one of their assets, period. So the FBI's Pat Kond is who lays out this ideology to the whole Patriot movement in the 1990s. And we're seeing that you can see what the Order wanted, what Pat Kond, the FBI fake organization, what they're, you can see all of that in J6. You can see it in Q, which I think we've talked about here before, is an FBI movement itself. It was created by the FBI along with Pat Kond. Like most of everything leading up to J6 was created by the FBI. And, you know, Unification Church, we'll get back to that.
I mean, it's like they make this stuff so they have something to do.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I have it here in my notes. It took mere weeks for Pat Kond to abandon their original reason for forming, saying that the threats against three FBI agents were not serious as they initially thought. But as a Group 1 undercover operation, they had good funding and were expected to be ambitious.
That's these people key. Don't want peace. No. They want white supremacist groups to be like fucking mobilizing yep. because then they're like, oh, need more money for my toys and my guns and my fucking militarized police force.
The original targeted agents were even removed from the group. So the original agents that were probably genuinely targeted by the Aryan movement in Texas were like taken out of PatCon because it was a conflict of interest. So PatCon would continue to expand across state lines and organizational lines. So it would start to be, they were starting to hand off sects of PatCon to non-FBI leaders. I mean,
what?
Yeah. So they're giving these like these brutal blueprints for the Jewish cabal to destroy the Jewish cabal is being handed out by the FBI to actual Nazi leaders in the United States.
You know what? That makes so much sense to me mm-hmm. because of I'm lying. It makes no sense.
Oh, okay. I was like, mm-hmm, go ahead.
No, it makes no fucking sense.
Well, I thought you were maybe going to say, makes sense to me because my taxes are so high.
I mean, yeah.
Because we are paying for this. American citizens, this is what you're paying for.
I hate all the things that I have to pay for.
Right. And this is like, instead of like really good healthcare, really good food, a place schools. To live, schools, like all the stuff you just like to have. And that would reduce like crime in overall and just take the stress out of your life. So yeah. you could just enjoy yourself and contribute to society in the ways that you want to.
Yeah, no, can't do that.
Can't do that.
Got to get more war guns.
We need more Nazis.
For the boys.
Yeah.
Gotta make more Nazis so the boys have something to do, but better make them Nazis because they're really familiar with that group of people because they are also.
All of that I just said is from, it's from an academic article by J.M. Berger. It's a research paper by J.M. Berger that was written in 2012, and I found it in the New America Foundation Journal on Internet Archive.
Nice.
In the Oklahoma City bombing, we have three men. They're all white, they're all American, and they all met in the Army. It's Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and Michael Fortier. We know all three of these people were involved and did time on them,
yeah.
right? Terry Nichols is going to be in prison forever. Timothy McVeigh was executed, and Michael Fortier turned whatever evidence he turned and went into a witness protection program, ostensibly with his wife, Lori. So... But again, in the American imagination, we don't have that. We don't talk about all of those people. We only talk about Timothy McVeigh and the homegrown American terrorist. Time magazine put his face on the cover of it in 1995 or 96, and it said American terrorist. And I think, and the reason that we had to have this happen, they had to have this happen, is they wanted to pass these terrorism laws, this omnibus of terrorism, right? Stuff that they wanted to pass. But the American public was being very much swayed by the truth, which is that anti-terrorism laws disproportionately affected Muslims.
Uh-huh.
And this is back in 95.
Uh-huh.
This is before you get the trade towers brought to you by Bush and company. Okay. So when Muslims were saying we're being disproportionately harmed by terrorism laws, the politicians and the public were like, well, let's not do that. So the FBI needed to change literally the face of terrorism.
Oh, wow.
Right. So Timothy McVeigh becomes that face. Time magazine even says the face of terrorism. And, you know, this is a time period, too. You don't have, you know, you have internet in the 90s, but it's not like it is now.
No.
You know, you have to type in like a website, the whole thing, www. You know, like you have to get it right even. You can't even be off by a letter, right? You have to get it right to get to that website. You don't have news just popping up in your computer, much less in your hand, right? So what was on the covers of the magazines at the grocery store, whether you purchase them or not,
That's was, like your Twitter feed.
That's like your Twitter feed. It had an enormous impact on culture and just what you believed. It's, you know, it's where feminists were coming in and saying, like, can we get these cosmopolitan magazines out of here? I mean, can you at least put them in the back or like whatever, right? Because these covers are destructive. All covers of magazines during these years are destructive, and especially you put them right there at the end aisle at the checkout, and there's the same magazines at every aisle in every store. So every American and kids and old people, right? It's not even age specific, right? Are getting the same whatever, you know, 10, 15 messages that were there on those magazines. So when Time Magazine, whatever, the man of the year, you know, whoever that was going to be, that told you what to think. And when they said American the face of terrorism, it was a big deal. It was a big deal in a way that it wouldn't be now. So the Oklahoma City bombing caused the media to turn to a new fear of right-wing terrorism, of anti-government patriots. This is interesting. Look how long ago this is.
Yeah.
Right? So, and they're, and like not just the patriots themselves, but the belief in conspiracy theories. So there had to be all of this fear around these conspiracy theories that these patriots believed that they were getting from the FBI. So if,
do you know like what kind of conspiracy theories?
Well, like that the government is run by a Jewish cabal.
Oh God.
Right?
Yeah, the anti-Semitic kind.
Right.
Ugh. The worst kind.
The worst kind. And then later on, my opinion, but a Q, I mean, it's not really my opinion. Q is an FBI operation. And so all of these, you know, quote unquote stupid people, well, if your stupid government wouldn't have been feeding them stupid ideas, they'd be smart. It's just my opinion on that one. But so all of these things that we have come, that have come true now, because all of this is out of pocket. It's not like the FBI can handle it. And I think that that's, you know, part of that book, Chaos, that's about the Manson murders. I mean, that was Operation Chaos.
Yeah.
So this is really, I mean, is this part of Operation Chaos? If not, it's certainly using the same attitude.
Right.
Is to create, like, what happens when you really do create an Aryan movement in the United States, a Nazi movement in the United States? What happens when you just make one?
Yeah, it gives you more leverage to, like, control people because you give them something that they need, are afraid of.
Right. And then who really is the mouthpiece for all of this? It's the mainstream media who's explaining it to everyone and putting these ideas out there and using basically human psychology to, like, to play the devil's advocate, right? So you have these people who just, I mean, I think in a lot of situations, you know, you've got Rush Limbaugh or Alex Jones, who is not, we're not mainstream, but even now you get Rachel Maddow, I'll tell you what all these dumb patriots think about the Jewish cabal, you know, and it's like, girl, just shut up.
Yeah.
Everybody just be, don't talk about that. But you can imagine in these, you know, hetero homes where it's really gendered also. And the guy's like, well, I don't know, babe. Maybe it is like blah, 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 right? You can... You can see how this starts to take root. Anyway, so on April 23rd, a friend of McVeigh from Michigan, this is in 1995 after he's caught, told reporters, so this is a few days after he's caught, told reporters that McVeigh had told him that the government had put a tracking chip in him, that McVeigh believed that he had a tracking chip in him. And this is the same day that the FBI received a call from a woman named Linda Thompson, who is an attorney who produced the film Waco, The Big Lie, to tell them that U.S. soldiers, including McVeigh, had been microchipped by Dr. Jolly.
No.
Yes.
Whoa. That's crazy because previously I thought Dr. Jolly didn't come on the scene till this story until after Timothy McVeigh was arrested.
We'll have to get through this whole book to see what they say here. Yeah, we knew he was connected, but I can't remember.
Yeah, because he talks to Timothy McVeigh while he's incarcerated.
While he's incarcerated.
As like a, you know, investigating the the psychological profile or something, or like a a psychologist that comes in to be like, yeah, this dude's crazy,
right?
Or I not. Bet.
Yeah, I bet he's front end and back end on this. That's right. He talks to him afterwards. Yeah, but apparently. But now, so this attorney,
this motherfucker.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, you want to talk about somebody who gets around. Like Dr. Jolly.
He's in everything.
He's in everything. If it's insane and nefarious, it's like, where's Jolly? Where is he?
He's in the back of this photo.
Yeah, there he is. Yeah, totally. So, or somebody's like, oh, he was standing right next to me, I thought, when that photo was taken.
Bum, ba-da-dum. Bum, bum, bum. This is such a spooky Halloween episode.
It is a spooky Halloween episode. It's Linda Thompson, who I think will come up later, and she's both an attorney and also somebody who produced a film about Waco. So anybody could have been radicalized in whatever way, any direction, by Waco. If you were paying attention, you could have gone very far any direction seeing what happened that day and knowing. I mean, the U.S. government burned almost 30 kids alive in a bus. If that doesn't change who you are, I don't know what will, right? So we don't know. Linda Thompson could have been a totally normal person, and then one day she was like, what? And she made this film, Waco, The Big Lie. And then she called the FBI. This was just a couple of days after McVeigh has been arrested. And she's like, hey, by the way, these soldiers were microchipped by the government. And then this friend of McVeigh's like corroborates that story, at least insofar as McVeigh believed it. But McVeigh believed a lot of things.
How does she know this about McVeigh? Did she meet him like at Waco, or find out about him through, because he was at Waco?
Yeah, he was at Waco. He was wearing
his white supremacist stuff. What was that called? The Turner Diaries?
Oh,
or
yeah,
something?
The Turner Diaries. Yeah. Right, right, right. And
good job, memory.
Yeah, nice.
Look at my little memory. I almost remember the sheep dipping thing too.
Yeah, you were very close.
Good for me.
Yeah, it was. It was the Turner Diaries. And I guess this is during the time when he's like traveling the gun show circuit. And he like goes to Waco and winds up watching this siege, which according to McVeigh is what radicalized him. That's what he says. He sounds like he was a little wing nutty before
convenient
that.
Convenient excuse.
Convenient excuse,
like many
indeed.
Things.
So I am assuming, so Linda Thompson, I don't know. We'll talk about Linda Thompson, I think, more as things go on. But I was assuming that also she found McVeigh at Waco. But it sounds like she must have studied more than that, like in terms of like what was happening to soldiers and so on. So we'll see as we come back around to her. I assume we will. Okay, this is what Dr. Wendy Painting writes about it. While acts of politically motivated violence committed on American soil by U.S. citizens were by no means a new phenomenon, an emergent category of homegrown domestic terrorism increasingly occupied a central place in terrorism discourse. And the arrest of Timothy McVeigh brought forth the rhetorical coupling of conspiracy theorists and others with a newly emergent terrorist threat. In response, all manner of claim makers garnered support for a range of new policies and practices meant to combat the existence and spread of threatening ideologies and subcultures. On Monday, April 24th, 1995, President Clinton assured the public that he would expand the powers and budgets granted to counterterrorism and intelligence agencies to give law enforcement more effective means of investigating extremist groups in order to root out and eradicate whatever larger threat the bombing might indicate. Prior to the bombing, Congress refused to pass a controversial anti-terrorism bill proposed by the Clinton administration, but on April 25th, the first draft of it passed in the Senate, and a year later passed in its final form with overwhelming bipartisan support. The newer version of the previously proposed legislation greatly increased the powers and budgets allotted to counterterrorism, effectively investigating, monitoring, and eradicating extremist groups through the FBI's and other law enforcement agencies' use of undercover surveillance and sting operations. Further, the new legislation retroactively allowed prosecutors to seek the death penalty for any suspect convicted of participation in the OKC bombing.
Convenient.
Very convenient. Very convenient for all the wrong people. So now that happens the day, that's on April 24th. Now the day before, as of April 23rd, the police were looking for 4 to 6 unidentified co-conspirators. These people are seen. Like, everybody sees Timothy McVeigh. We'll get into this more. And there's all this surveillance footage that just disappears. You know how that happens, right? Or where you can't tell what's happening. We're not going to release it because there's just one shadowy figure in it. It gets said somewhere and it's like, okay, so release it.
Yeah.
Let us see the shadow. And they're like, no, no, no. We feel like that'll confuse things. You know? So convenient. And so if you can imagine too, you know, this is the Oklahoma City Police Department, and they, you know, they probably have family or friends that were in that building that were, or, you know, whatever, right? This is their community. So they're the police in Oklahoma City, not the FBI, right? But the police in Oklahoma City are going to be connected to what's happening in that building. And that's a lot of people to go down in one city, right? In one day. There's going to be, they're going to have repercussions in their own personal lives, right? So they're out looking for 4 to 6 unidentified conspirators. And I'm sure that they care about that, right? Yeah. They care about finding those people.
Yeah.
So for the government to just come in and say, okay, yeah, no, never mind. Forget that. We've got this guy. Good enough. That's got to be some sick shit. I'd be super interested to hear from former OKC police officers during that time.
Well, like in the movie A Noble Lie, one of the, I mean, characters, one of the people profiled in it is a police officer who was like, this doesn't add up. Guess what happened to him? He gets fucking killed.
Right. I guess we won't be hearing from him.
Right.
Way to go, FBI.
I don't know. You got another one.
Yeah, got another one. I mean, I bet we see that all over the place in this case. The more things go on.
Yeah, they shut down the X-Files, bro.
That's right. And so, but 2 days prior to that, even, on April 21st, when McVeigh was arrested, he made what Painting calls a strange confession to his appointed counsel. So this is on the day he's arrested. This is fascinating. This is what he says. Unknown to the public, but documented within the Jones collection, Jones winds up being the second attorney that McVeigh has. So, but McVeigh is saying this to his first set of attorneys, which he fires.
Okay.
But McVeigh had made a very strange confession. He told Coyle and Otto, those were his original attorneys, that while in the National Guard, which he had joined after leaving active duty Army service, he had been recruited to work undercover as part of a domestic security operation. McVeigh said his mission was to infiltrate and report on neo-Nazis and other domestic terrorism threats.
Period. That's what I already fucking said.
Right. This is, yeah, and it's coming, of course, he says it too.
Well, McVeigh, he says a lot of things. Yeah, oh my God, no, I'm being McVeighed.
I don't think you can help it in this story. He's somewhere, dead or alive.
I'm just like, wow, Timothy McVeigh said the exact thing I was thinking, except he says every single thing that everybody's thinking. All right. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
No, it's okay, because it is kind of funny. You're like, just he's like
getting McVeighed in real time.
Over and over again. God, that's how my Painting must feel every day. Like, I've been McVeighed. So McVeigh then said that after having discovered the bombing plot, he reported it to his handlers, but was instructed to continue in his role, remain embedded within the conspiracy, and even go so far as to participate in the bombing, but ensure that only a couple of windows were blown out of the Murrah building. McVeigh expressed his shock that the writer could have caused as much damage as it did, and wondered out loud if someone may have switched the truck at the last minute without his knowledge. While within the weeks and months to come, his story would undergo radical transformation, McVeigh's initial confession to Otto and Coyle stands as, while not the first, the earliest known post-arrest guilty agent story that McVeigh would tell. What's interesting about maybe the Ryder truck was switched, that he says that, is because later someone at the Dreamland Hotel, where he parks that truck before the bombing, says that he parked a faded out, like sun faded Ryder truck. And then later on, because he was there for two nights, I think, but by the third morning, it was a bright yellow Ryder truck.
Weird.
Yeah, right? So it is weird. Of course, that having been said, there's no way that somebody like McVeigh wouldn't be like, this isn't the same truck.
Right.
So if the truck did get traded, which we do have outside witnesses saying that they noticed this, then McVeigh would have known it also.
But he denies it. Or he plays dumb.
Yeah, in that first confession, he's playing dumb. But what, and then there's some other, like, initially it wasn't supposed to explode, and like all these things get said, obviously. I just found that to be really interesting. So on the first day that he's arrested, he's like, yeah, but I was part of this larger picture and this wasn't supposed to happen. That's what he said anyway. So
I do think that, like, soldiers, without making like a moral judgment call on them, are most of the time exploited and done mind control on them to get them to do stuff that they wouldn't maybe normally do.
Yeah, agreed.
Like in Vietnam, mm-hmm. You pump those kids full of amphetamines, get them to murder other kids, you know?
Yeah.
And then they're fucked up forever and then y'all treat them like shit.
Right.
And they did a lot of fucked up things, you know, but right. They did it also because they were like manipulated and drugged by the government.
Absolutely.
Then Timothy McVeigh, maybe not the best and brightest, just wants to feel special. That's what the vibe is, you know? He gets like recruited to do all these different secret things. And then they get him to like do all this fucked up stuff he can never come back from, you know? Like up until he bombs this building, everything he's done, he can be like, oh, well, I did it for the government and so it doesn't count. Like, yeah. Oh, I'm not actually a white supremacist. I was just like doing it undercover for the government, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't really go back from bombing a building, especially when the government is like not gonna cover for you. Right. You know, he just winds up being like a fall guy.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't be surprised if he thought it was gonna be something different, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's possible.
Because there's bombs that don't hurt people. There's bombs that just scare, you know?
He at one point says that that's what he thought was going to happen. Because at one point he says I'm
psychically connected to Timmy McVeigh.
Totally right.
I'm going to look in the mirror and say Timothy McVeigh three times. And then and he's going to show up and be like, did you read my white supremacist literature? And I'll say, no, thank you.
Get out of my house, Timothy McVeigh.
I don't want it. Yeah. Can't convey me anymore. I've been watching too much X-Files.
Well, and it is Halloween coming up.
Spooky.
Well, there is one part in here also where Evans Ambrose Pritchard, that we talked about before, who wrote that book on the Clintons,
yeah,
he has a lot to say about the Timothy McVeigh case.
What's his Tory got to say?
Yeah, he's a Tory. See, this memory, your memory's working great. Yeah, Ambrose Pritchard is the Brit. He's the Tory. He's the right-wing Brit guy, and that we talked about during the Clinton episodes. But he made the observation that when Timothy McVeigh was doing his perp walk, you know, where they walk him in handcuffs and everybody, you know, the media's out there taking pictures, recording. Why'd you do it? Why'd you do it? You know, like all that stuff. What Pritchard is saying is that this is this important moment because how the accused look as they go, that's going to be your picture. That's what goes in the paper. And people look for a lot in your face and in your gestures.
You're going to get analyzed.
You're going to get analyzed a lot. And he said, you know, generally speaking, perps have a lot of fear, and they're, you know, like you had, like Oswald was like, I'm a patsy, right? During his perp walk, right? Which goes down in big time history. But Pritchard noted that McVeigh did exactly the opposite. Like he got this, he was impervious to all of it. And he went and he had this very cold look on his face. And Pritchard says, you know, he gave them exactly what they wanted. during the perp walk. I think that's another interesting point, right? So instead of saying, I'm a patsy, you know, or whatever, or making them put your head down, because if you... Have you seen that where the cops push your head down? Right, because that's when you're like, I'm innocent or I'm just human. You know, they don't like you to have that look on your face. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was in here too. In February of 1986, Terry Nichols' lawyer motioned for a severance because McVeigh had been so public already that Nichols' lawyers knew Nichols could not get a fair trial in Oklahoma. Timothy McVeigh would talk to anyone, basically. And so would his lawyer, Jones, his second lawyer, was trying to get a media campaign that would favor Timothy McVeigh, you know, so that it would make him look like...
okay.
Yeah, good right?
luck.
Right. And it didn't work at all. But what it did do was muddle... the ability to give a fair trial, right? Okay. It did really muddle the whole situation. So, and that's also another reason why we know more about McVeigh. We just look at McVeigh because he wanted that. And so apparently did his second lawyer, which might be why he fired the first two and got the second one, got Jones, which he eventually has a falling out with also. But Jones wanted to do anybody who wanted to talk, he wanted to talk. He wanted to give this face of McVeigh as, hapless in some way, right? And McVeigh would talk to anyone. So they were contaminating the trial by doing this. So the lawyers for the other guys were like, well, we're not putting our client in cahoots with McVeigh, which works for McVeigh. McVeigh also wanted to be the lone wolf at times, right? So... at any rate, they want to get this severance. And according to painting, public opinion polls in Oklahoma showed that the majority believed both McVeigh and Nichols were guilty and deserved the death penalty. So they wanted to get, which eventually later, many, you know, 9 years later, Nichols finally gets like, you know, 27 consecutive life sentences or something like that, right? But at the time, I don't know what happened at the time. So, by July of 1995, the FBI called off the search for other conspirators. So just a few months later, they were like, okay, done.
Got it.
Done. Right. I mean, how fast all of this happens is crazy. Right. So that leaves McVeigh and Nichols facing the death penalty and Fortier as a conspirator. On August 11th, 1995, the grand jury returned an indictment statement. And I want to say this before I read this from painting, but they often say about a grand jury that a grand jury could indict a ham sandwich. Because there is no... defense doesn't make any statements. It's prosecutors only. It's,
cool.
Yeah, no, it's part of the reason why... I mean, it has a, like, when it comes to like qualified immunity and getting cops prosecuted and so on and so forth, grand juries are a big problem for that. So anyway, but maybe we'll talk about that another time. But the defense doesn't have anything to say, so you only hear the prosecution side. And that's why the joke is a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich, right? So here is what gets said. This is in Painting's book. Beginning on or about September 13th, 1994, and continuing thereafter until about April 19th, 1995, McVeigh and Nichols did knowingly, intentionally, willfully, and maliciously conspire, combine... Wait, I gotta start this over.
Okay.
On August 11th, 1995, the federal grand jury returned an indictment that read, beginning on or about September 13th, 1994, and continuing thereafter until on or about April 19th, 1995, McVeigh and Nichols did knowingly, intentionally, willfully, and maliciously conspire, combine, and agree together with others unknown to use a weapon of mass destruction. The indictment listed 27 overt acts that created a narrative of the plot and concluded that McVeigh attempted to recruit others to assist in the act of violence, a reference to McVeigh's many pre-bombing phone calls and suspicious associations. If they existed at all, the identities of the others unknown mentioned in the indictment remained a mystery, although the phrase itself suggested the possibility of additional arrests. During a press conference explaining the indictments, Janet Reno made the contradictory statement that while the investigation was ongoing, most of the John Doe 2 leads had been pursued and exhausted.
Janet Reno, you bitch!
Absolutely, because that's not true.
I hate her.
Yeah, I know. She's terrible. So that was the grand jury's indictment. Again, you're always going to get an indictment from a grand jury, but for them to actually come back and talk about these others unknown, I thought was really interesting, considering that it was just McVeigh and Nichols there and all that really needed to happen. Like, once you get to this point, you can very easily just be talking about people trying to get their job done as quickly as possible.
Absolutely.
Right? So for them to be like, actually, there's others unknown, I thought was interesting in a situation like that. So survivors and families of the victims and other interested parties formed what they called the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigating Committee. So I guess it's OKBIC. I'm just assuming. But this is where Ambrose Evan Pritchard, he called them the OKC Dissidents. Because these people who got together, they're
like, I don't believe this story.
Right. We don't believe the official story. And they were across all these different lines, like people who maybe normally wouldn't be aligned. And they weren't abiding by certain rules of information, rules, quote unquote, of information gathering. They're like, we'll take anything. You have a conspiracy theory? Come here. Tell me what it is. Uh-huh. Right. So they were taking anything from anybody who felt like they had anything to say. This group was like, say it. Great.
Yeah.
Right. And they uncovered a lot of stuff. So this group pursued, information about the plot to bomb the Murrah building. And this is what they got. So I'm just going to read a long part out of here, like a page and a half. The information uncovered additional wrinkles of complexity in an already complex situation that, although raising more questions than it answered, proved irrefutably damning to the government's story. The combined investigatory efforts led to revelations about its prior knowledge, it's being the government, prior knowledge of the bombing, and shed light on the possible identities of several other conspirators. Among the most publicized of these revelations were those concerning McVeigh's relationship to the cast of characters residing in or frequently visiting Elohim City, including Andreas Strassmeyer, Andy the German, a German national living in the U.S. on an expired visa and head of a paramilitary training operation at Elohim City. Elohim City had only one telephone that was shared by the entire community. Residents there remembered that on April 5th, 1995, 2 weeks before the bombing, McVeigh called looking for Strassmeyer. McVeigh, Strassmeyer, the FBI, and prosecutors maintained that the two met once at a Tulsa gun show 2 years earlier, in 1993, at which point Strassmeyer invited McVeigh, who introduced himself as Tim Tuttle, to the community, the Elohim community. Then, on April 17th, 1995, and again on April 18th, McVeigh called CAUSE, the racist legal organization that represented Strassmeyer. So McVeigh called this organization CAUSE, a racist legal organization that represented Strassmeyer. He had called them 2 days in a row right before the bombing. Although an FBI memo dated April 20th, 1995, the day after the bombing, stated it is suspected that members of Elohim City are involved in the bombing, either directly or indirectly through conspiracy, no real investigation into these links was conducted, and Strassmeyer was questioned only by telephone. Yes?
The German sounds made up. This sounds like a cartoon character.
Andy
That's
the
all
German.
I wanted to say. Yeah. I'm like, oh yeah, this German guy is coming to. If a German Nazi was living in America, he'd be working for NASA.
Ooh.
He wouldn't be in Elohim City. Sorry, that's all I have to say.
Burn.
Gotcha, NASA, you bitch.
Let's see. The link was conducted and Strassmeyer was questioned only by telephone and only after he had been allowed to leave the country and return to Germany. Nevertheless, suspicions about him persisted. According to Roger Charles, a number of strange details and circumstances surrounding his life strongly suggest that Strassmeyer was not the radical right-winger he appeared to be and might even have been a government agent of some sort spying on extremists or working for NASA. No kidding. In the United States.
Over the, I was like, oh my God!
Like, I knew it!
I fucking called it!
Over the years, Strassmeyer spoke to a handful of journalists. In 1997, while denying his involvement in the bombing, he told Evans Pritchard that the bombing was a sting operation permeated by undercover agents and informants that acquired a momentum of its own. Like, okay. That's something we were talking about, right? Because, like, here's the FBI making this chaos.
Yeah.
So, but this is Strassmeyer elaborated, I assume in a heavy German accent, but I won't use that. The ATF, FBI, and different agencies were cooperating. In fact, they were working against each other. You even had a situation where one branch of the FBI was investigating and not sharing with another branch. The ATF had something going on with McVeigh. They were watching him, of course they were. McVeigh knew he was delivering a bomb, but he had no idea what was in that truck. He just wanted to shake things up a little, you know, make a gesture. The bomb was never meant to explode. They were going to arrest McVeigh at the site with the bomb in hand, but he didn't come at the right time. Maybe he changed the time. You never know with people who are so unreliable. I have heard that they were expecting the bomb to go off in the middle of the night between 2 and 3 in the morning. The truck had a transmitter so they could track it with a radio receiving device. I don't know how they could have lost contact. I think there was misinformation and the operation had been canceled. That's what Strassmeyer says. So when asked if he thought the agents and informants would reveal themselves, Strassmeyer responded, "How can he? What happens if it was a sting operation from the very beginning? What happens if it comes out that the plant was a provocateur? What if he talked and manipulated the others into it? What then? Then the country couldn't handle it. The relatives of the victims are going to go crazy, and he's going to be responsible for the murder of 168 people? Of course the informant can't come forward. He's scared shitless right now."
Ooh.
Yeah, right? That is a... That's what Strassmeyer had to say. So.
The German. The German, totally Andy, real the normal German. Guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So just to leave us with this, I'm going to read another paragraph from Wendy Painting and another. I'm just going to read another paragraph from Wendy Painting. So by the time of his indictment on April 27, 1995, Timothy McVeigh had already been depicted as a demon, a lone wolf, or one of a pack, a CIA agent, an FBI informant, patsy, government guinea pig, disgruntled soldier, fallen war hero, loser, loner, gun nut, and conspiracy theorist. In the chapters that follow, I examine the origins of all of these stories, compare several existing works about him to each other, and introduce new, never-before-published information, thereby offering a hidden biography of Timothy McVeigh. In many ways, this book is a story about stories, the people who tell stories, the stories they tell, and the reasons they tell them. Before telling McVeigh's backstory, I want to briefly outline 5 commonly told narrative variations: the lone wolf, the pack of wolves, the closely watched wolves, the guilty agent, and the experimental wolf. So that's what we'll be getting into in upcoming episodes, are those 5 basic stories that she's found. Painting, this is all her idea. Like, she's bringing all of these documents together, and she pulled out what she considers to be the 5 basic narratives, and those are what they are. And all of those narratives were told by McVeigh within the first few days of having been arrested. And look at all those things that had already said about him before he was indicted, just a few days later.
Yeah.
So all of that had already, the public and everyone had already been introduced to all these ideas, contradictory ideas about McVeigh within a week. So there you have it.
Well, thanks, Michelle. I'm like really excited to be getting deeper into this.
Yeah, me too. It's
like the longer we do this podcast, we just get deeper and deeper into, I feel like, a few main topics that truly really kind of like define or like are just major moments in government fuckery.
Yeah, they're places where a lot of these bad actors, so to speak, cross paths and ideologies and create scenarios that we can't get ourselves out of.
And that kill a lot of people and kids.
Yeah, a lot of kids. Yeah, a lot of kids, because it motivates people. We're very motivated when kids are killed.
Yeah, yeah. It's so tragic.
Right.
And yeah, leave them out. Leave them alone.
Right.
And save the kids all over the world.
Absolutely.
Y'all don't give a fuck about kids unless it forwards your own personal agenda.
Right.
Y'all, as in the government, not as in you Secret Antenna listeners, who are all my best friends.
You're the coolest people on the planet.
Yeah, that's so
cool. And you
know
it.
Yeah. I mean, you should know it. I hope you know it.
Right. So thanks for being here, and we'll talk to you next time.
Okay. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you, Callie.
All right. See y'all next time.
Bye.
Like the Bye Bye Bird, let him rest through the streets.